The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2017 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2017. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
My name is Bill Simmer. I am with ISM, Independent School Management. How many of you have heard of ISM before? A couple of you. So what our purpose here today is just to chat a little bit about ISM's both research and observations related to head of school behaviors and attitudes that are effective. So let's talk about, first of all, what we would mean by effective. So from ISM's perspective, an effective head is going to do this. An effective head is going to help their school implement the mission of their school in the lives of their students over time with viability in the context of the institution. So I want to say that again. When I say effective, what do I mean? By effective, I mean I am taking the mission that we say we are trying to implement in the lives of children, and we are succeeding at doing that. Our children are graduating from our school, and they have, in fact, integrated that mission into their lives, and they go out and live it. But more than that, I'm not just doing that as a flash in the pan. I'm setting up an institution that's going to last for a significant amount of time, 100 years, whatever it takes. And I'm doing that with the realization that I have to run my institution in such a way that it is viable, that it doesn't go bankrupt, that I'm able to pay my teachers reasonably, that I attend to the realities of money. I think, as we all know, there's nothing more spiritual than money. Now, we laugh because in the modern Christian mindset, we've convinced ourselves that that's not the case. But the reality is the Bible talks more about money than just about any other kind of subject. In fact, rumor has it, there's a gentleman, I'm trying to remember his name, that said, if you show me where a person's money is, I can tell you where what is. Their heart is also. Think about that for a second. That's a pretty serious statement. If you tell me where a person's money is, I'll tell you where their heart is. So as Christian educators and as heads of school, one of the first things I want to get on the table is, as particularly as Christians, we've got to get rid of some of the stinking thinking that exists in the Christian school movement about money. Money is not an ugly thing. The love of money and materialism is an ugly thing. But no one here in this room, I believe, wants money to do materialistic, horrible things. We want money because we want to take that money and we want to use it in a way that transforms the lives of children. And so in that case, as Dallas Willard would say, we are taking that money and we are sanctifying that money in the process. So this wasn't really in my outline, but I'm just going to jump in here and say one of the characteristics of an effective head of school is they have their head on right about money. It's a good thing to want to pay my teachers well. It's a good thing to have a robust financial aid budget so that I can have people that can't afford my school come there. It's a good thing to have facilities that are professional and well-kept. It's a good thing to be able to have an institution that is sustainable and strong. And anyone who develops a theology that tries to tell you that's not a good thing, I would be very apprehensive about listening to what they have to say. Especially in the richest nation in the world. Now, if you're in the Sahara, in the backwoods, there may be a lot of things that God calls upon you to do, but in North America, in wealthy North America, there is no way that any child that wants a Christian education shouldn't have the money for it. I won't belabor the point, but we all understand American Christians don't tithe. They spend about 3% of their money. Your parents complain about money even as they drive up in carpool in a Lexus or a BMW, or talk about the vacation in France they just had. So it's a delusion that there is not the money out there. Last time I checked, my father owned the cattle on a thousand hills. And so the reality is do we have a commitment and do we place as a priority the development of the next generation? Do we really believe that we are developing a generation for Christ that's going to impact our world, or do we understand the significance of that? I think we all understand the world understands the significance of that. The enemy understands the significance of that. Where has the enemy invested himself? He's invested himself in media, in Hollywood, and in education. Because the enemy knows that if I cut off the head of the snake, I kill the snake. Fortunately, we have a master whose heel was bruised, but that was all that he could pull off. But it is our job in our time and in our world to move that project forward. So what I want to share with you today is the last 40 years of ISM and a combination of both research. Obviously, those of you who are familiar with us know that we are a research institution. We've done research a couple of times related to the concept of a head of school. We're just finishing up some additional research that we've done. I'm going to be able to share some of those preliminary findings with you. So I want to share some of that, but I also want to integrate some observations of myself and other ISM consultants who've been working with schools and been working with heads of schools for years, things that we've seen that are the difference makers, that are changeable. I'm not going to be talking about anything related to the spiritual or biblical life of a head, because I assume that we all are on track with that. So I'm assuming that you're all understanding the importance of doing your daily devotions, of spending time with God, of trusting God, of putting Christ first, all of those things. You probably have an opportunity to hear that an awful lot. I'm going to jump right into the more mundane aspects and worldly aspects of your job that are just as important. In fact, I don't know about you, but at this point in my spiritual journey, I don't even know what it means to dichotomize my spiritual life from my regular life. You know, it's all just one big spiritual life, isn't it? And so this is important for us as heads of school, because if I can go back to that idea of money, we need to start to think of a balanced budget as a spiritual exercise and not separate it from the other things that we do. We need to think of taking care of our faculty as a spiritual exercise, not disconnected. There's not my spiritual life and then, oh, my normal life. My whole life is spiritual. So let's talk a little bit about some of the characteristics that we see. So the first characteristic that we see, and perhaps the most important that we see among effective heads, is that they understand what their number one priority is as a leader. And as a head of school, your number one priority is to ensure that your school has a healthy, robust faculty culture. I want to say that again. Your number one priority is to make sure that your school has a healthy and robust faculty culture. So part of what that means is that we have to get out of kumbaya language about what a healthy culture is, and we have to get into research-based, brass tacks reality about what a healthy faculty culture is and what a healthy faculty culture isn't. I'll never forget, I spoke to one head of school whose school was struggling. And I asked her about her faculty culture. And she said to me, she said, "My faculty is great. They all have their certifications, they all have their master's degrees, and they are all followers of Jesus Christ." And I said to her, I said, "That's wonderful, but you haven't mentioned a single thing that tells me whether you have good teachers or not. Because there is no correlation between being certified and being a good teacher. There's no correlation between having a master's degree and being a good K-12 teacher. And I'm sorry to say, but the world is full of people that love Christ and have committed their life to him, that it would be a train wreck to have them in the front of a classroom." So we have to understand and educate ourselves as heads of school about what does it mean to have a healthy faculty culture. I've spoken on that in the past. But basically, I've got to have people who understand the mission of my school and implement it into their classroom. I've got to have people who are immersed and constantly growing in professional development, that are reading what's out there in the field and being willing to tweak and work on their curriculum and their tests in a real-time kind of way. I've got to have a faculty that are student-centric. Now, here I have to stop, because I got in trouble last year. I got scolded because I said, faculty should be student-centric. The leadership came back and said, you know, several of our people here mentioned that, you know, we are a Christ-centric organization, not a student-centric organization. This is one of those moments where I kind of want to smile and shrug my shoulders at my Christian brothers and sisters. Of course we are Christ-centric. You know, when I come to a conference that says Association of Christian Classical Schools, forgive me, but I make the assumption that we have all committed to Christ as the center of our life, right? I mean, if you want to talk about Christ-centricity, your next breath comes from God. So yes, of course you want to be Christ-centric, but I'm talking about in a tactical sense, schools exist for children. The whole point of having schools is to see children develop. And I can't think of any more Christ-centric behavior than to keep children at the front of the conversation if you're the head of a Christian school. So I think what happens is when I say Christ-centric, some of you go into Eastern mysticism, hippie crazy land and assume that that's what I'm talking about, and that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about having a faculty who, whenever they make a decision, whenever they make a programmatic change, whenever they make a curriculum change, at the center of that conversation is, what is the impact on our students? If we're going to change the schedule, how does that impact our students? It's about the students. This is very important because independent schools in general, but Christian schools as well, naturally move towards adult centricity. The majority of Christian schools that I have worked with, the reality is it's become about the adults. It's become about placating the faculty or placating the parents or placating the board. Here's the thing about authority and leadership in the Christian context. We serve a Lord whose last act when he left his disciples was to what? What did he do the last time he had a real meeting with his disciples before he walked out to be slaughtered? Say it. Come on, I want to hear it. Well, the Great Commission, but what did he do? He washed their feet. Now, I want you to stop and think for a second. Seriously, put down your pens just for a second and just think about this. We need to park on that for a second. The almighty Logos through which the world was created, the third member of the Trinity, got on his knees, put a towel around his waist, and washed dirty, sandy, muddy feet. That's the God you serve. The God you serve is very explicit that leadership is service. He's direct about it. He says, don't you be like the leaders of this world. Don't you try to cling to power. Your position exists to serve the people under you, not to lord it over them. He's quite emphatic about it. And so to be child-centric is the best exercise of authority and leadership that a faculty can possibly have. The last thing that the faculty needs to be able to do is to be predictable and supportive. And that is true of your leadership and you as a head of school. So what do I mean when I talk about predictable and supportive? You know, predictable and supportive is this continuum that as a leader I've got to walk. So what is predictability? Predictability is this. Everyone in my institution clearly understands what is expected of them. My hiring processes, my recruiting processes, my evaluation processes, my compensation processes all reinforce, articulate, reiterate, remind everyone, what is your role? What do I need you to do? What is the standard we are setting here? Predictability says, this is what positive behavior looks like in this context. This is what unacceptable behavior looks like in this context. And nobody has to wonder about what that looks like, either at the school as a whole or in my job individually. But predictability by itself is not enough. If you've got a boss that's just predictable, it's time to get a new job. Because predictability is the hard side of leadership, the clarity side of leadership. Predictability comes right next to this other thing called support. And that's why you can't think of them separate from each other. They're literally two sides of a coin. So great leaders expect great things from their people. They're very clear about those expectations. They insist and reinforce those expectations. But coming right alongside that, they say, I'm going to give you the resources, the support, the time, the training to succeed in those expectations. Those two things have to come together, or else your leadership will be flawed. So think of them as the tracks of a train on which the mission of your school runs. Predictability and supportiveness. That's a key aspect of being a head of school. So what do I mean by predictable? You know you're predictable when an errant parent starts to push up against a faculty member. And the faculty member nicely, kindly, politely, supportively says, this is the way we do things around here. And then, of course, I know that you don't have parents like this, but in this scenario, this parent isn't satisfied with that answer. And so they go to the division head, and they say, wah, wah, wah. And the division head said, politely, supportively, nicely, says, I'm sorry, Mrs. Johnson. Mrs. Smith was right. This is the way we do things around here. Now I'm really upset, and so what am I going to do as the modern parent? I'm going to go and get that squeaky wheel thing going, and I'm going to go to the head. And you know that your institution is predictable and supportive when even as that parent sits outside of your office, they're going, man, I just know what she's going to say. It's going to be the same thing. They all say the same thing. You're darn right they do. They may say it in different ways. They say it representing their particular personality type, their skill set, but there's a unanimity of message that runs through the institution. Kindly articulated, compassionately articulated. There are no nuns with rulers smacking you on the wrist here, but we can, in the context of kindness, be firm and resolute in what we believe. At ISM, we have this phrase, accurate reinforcement, compassionately delivered with a pro-constituent bias, and that is at the heart of what it means to be a head of school. Accurate reinforcement. I don't blow smoke. I don't tell you you've done good when you haven't just to fill the space of silence. But I do tell you you've done good when you did. I'm accurate in my reinforcement, but I deliver that reinforcement compassionately. I'm thoughtful about the way that I accurately reinforce you. I accurately reinforce you in ways that don't discourage you or push you down or keep you from being able to change or make you overly defensive. I find a way to get the message across that you can hear that message. And then I do it with a pro-constituent bias. What does that mean? I create an environment in my school where even as somebody maybe has to hear a hard message, they have no question in their mind that the person delivering that hard message wants to see them succeed. We all know this. It's a different world taking a hard message from a stranger who has no interest in our life or who maybe is a power monger who's just, you know, exerting control over me. But it's a different story when somebody who I know is trying to make me better, who sees the potential in me, who wants to lift me up, is giving me that hard message out of love. That's the environment that I want to create as a leader, and that's what good leaders do. They don't blow smoke. Heads of school, this is very important. In the Christian tradition, it has become in vogue to exercise unmerited praise. Because isn't that what Christians do? We're all so nice and we're all fluffy. So here's the deal. When you give unmerited praise, you are over time taking away the power of your reinforcement. Do you understand that? You want to save reinforcement for when reinforcement is due, because now your words have power and now they inspire. There's perhaps one exception to this rule, and the exception is a first-year teacher. Do you all remember what that was like? They might need a little bit of false reinforcement and encouragement, okay? But other than that, much beyond that, you need to be accurate in your reinforcement. I'm not saying being mean. I'm not saying being hateful. I'm saying being delightfully nice, but be nice when it's called for and be willing to open up a can when you have to. That's a technical term. You are the great reinforcer. Everybody's watching you. Every word that comes out of your mouth is open to a misinterpretation. You set the standard for your school. You're always on stage. You must pick your words carefully and thoughtfully. You must be mindful of them. The second characteristic, or another characteristic that we see about effective heads of school, and this is mentioned in Collins' work, Good to Great. How many of you have read Good to Great? It's a great book. You should all read Good to Great. I actually like Built to Last, the book before that. They're all great books. And Collins brings out this characteristic that we see in great leaders, and that is that great leaders are planners and visionaries. And I want to be very, very clear. I said planners and visionaries. I didn't just say visionaries. It's easy to come up with a vision. It's much more challenging to plan and to account and to find out how much that's going to cost and what are the facilities implications and what kind of personnel am I going to need. So planfulness is a very thoughtful exercise. I just taught a workshop yesterday, and we stressed the function with the board and the head of developing strategic plans. And what did I say to them? There is no strategic plan without an accompanying strategic financial plan. Otherwise, it's just a wish list. It's just happy talk. We have to count the cost when we plan. We have to be organized when we plan. We have to think about where the buck stops when we plan. But the reality is that great leaders are thinking into the future. In fact, that's one of the characteristics. Not everybody can do this, by the way. There are literally levels that represent periods of time. A level one leader, well, really no leader at all, can't really plan much more than about 3 to 6 months out in the horizon. They just can't crunch the variables. It's not that they're bad people. They've got other gifts. But they just don't have the gift of crunching all the variables and figuring out what it looks like as they project themselves into the future. Great leaders of level three or more can project themselves out into the future and see where the institution needs to go and inspire people to come along with them. Be very, very careful. You don't want to get so far out ahead that when you turn around, nobody's behind you. But great leaders are planful leaders. That's another characteristic that I've seen at ISM. Here's an interesting thing. Great leaders are charismatic. What a surprise, right? But there's a lot of caveats to that. In fact, at ISM, what we would call this is a kind of mooted charisma. So I don't like reading things to people in public, but I want to read this statement out of the research itself because I can't say it any better than this phrase says it. It says, charisma, as evidenced by an on-campus public presence that is seen as gracious, respectful, contemplative, self-effacing, and humble, yet at the same time suffused with a sense of moral purpose and integrity perceived by all as non-negotiable and impervious to political pressure. I will read it again. As evidenced by an on-campus public presence that is seen as gracious, respectful, contemplative, self-effacing, and humble, yet at the same time suffused with a sense of moral purpose and integrity perceived by all as non-negotiable and impervious to political pressure. Servant leadership is fierce. Servant leadership doesn't mean doormat. The wise man walks with his head down, but make no mistake about it, the wise man or woman also knows how to stand by their guns. And so there's a muted kind of charisma that we see. Another characteristic of this is you have to be a very, very good public and written communicator. That's just a reality. If your public speaking skills are a little bit sketchy, you're going to have to work on those. You're going to have to be able to speak publicly, and you're going to have to be able to write in a clear way to be an effective head. But something I want you to understand about charisma. We see this tendency in charisma that when people... charisma is too high, their charisma becomes a negative. Their charisma becomes the kind of thing that drowns people, that suffocates people, that closes down conversation among their deputies. So I've got to have a kind of charisma and a presence that gives that ethos, but I also can't be so overpowering with my personality that people can't talk to me and give their perspectives and feel like they can be in the mosh pit of decision-making with me. In fact, one of the other characteristics in our study that we saw is that heads of school, effective heads of school, are what are called flexible. While a decision is being made, they're very open to a host of different opinions. While the decision is being made. But at a certain point, of course, we have to make the decision, we have to all get on board, and we have to move forward. So there's this tension of charisma, but a charisma that doesn't drown everyone around me. And that's the tightrope that we have to walk as a head of school. By the way, I'm assuming that you all understand, you're welcome to jump in and ask any questions while I'm talking about this. So feel free. All right. Another thing that we see about heads of school, or that I've seen about heads of school in a very practical sense, is that you are an expert on all things related to board governance. The single greatest thorn in the side of the Christian school movement is dysfunctional boards across this nation. That is not my own opinion. If I were sitting here with Bruce Lockerbie and Alan Pugh and any host of other competent Christian consultants, I want to stress competent, they would all share the same opinion. Dysfunctional boards are undermining the Christian school movement. And the reality is that as a head of school, you are in a very tenuous position because you are an employee of the board, but you also must lead the board from behind, as it were. They're not professional educators like you are. And so if you want your board culture to become mature, if you want your board culture to become strong, if you want your board culture to be one that's going to support you, it behooves you to be an expert on all things related to board culture and governance. Because here's the reality, you will have to teach your boss. You're going to have to. You're going to have to teach your boss in most cases, what good board governance looks like, yes. So there are three primary governance philosophies. So I'm biased, obviously. There are three sources, really, that you have to go to that have any credibility, okay? So there's ISM, there's NAIS, and there is the Carver model. So there are various critiques you could lay of all of them. Most of them have about a 90% overlap. So not to offend any Carver people here, but if I were going to be critical of the Carver model, it's a broad model based on all kinds of not-for-profits. It's not a school-specific model. And the thing about schools, and I apologize, I don't have time to dive too deeply into this, is that private independent schools, and particularly Christian private independent schools, are highly idiosyncratic organisms. They break a lot of rules. They're highly counterintuitive in some ways. I mean, stop and think about it. I've got money and your child, okay? It doesn't get more primal than that, okay? And if that wasn't bad enough, I've got board members that are also parents, right? I'm a nonprofit, but people write a check and pay me tuition. I mean, it's all faculty as a labor pool, let's just talk about idiosyncratic. They consider themselves and view themselves more like doctors and lawyers, except really poorly paid doctors and lawyers. You ever try to corral a bunch of doctors and lawyers? So there's a lot of rules that private independent schools break, and Carver needs to be fiddled with to make sure it works well. So listen, better Carver than nothing, man. Carver, a lot of great schools running on the Carver model. So I'm just letting you know what the open, NAIS, too open and airy-fairy to interpretation. If your board wants to be creative, NAIS is a great one. But here's the problem. The problem with boards is not that they're not creative enough. Trust me. We need boards to be a lot less creative. Which brings me to the criticism voiced of ISM. We're overly didactic. We don't leave you a lot of room to get creative. We're very specific. You should have a head support and evaluation committee. You should evaluate the head in these specific metric-based ways. You should have a committee on trustee. You know what I'm saying? I mean, yeah. And so you have to pick your poison. But I'm biased towards ISM. Great question. And listen, it wouldn't hurt for you to know all of them. It's a lifetime of study. Which brings me to another characteristic of great heads. You can't just talk a good lifetime learning. And I know you guys. Some of y'all are talking lifetime learner, but you're really not studying and reading anymore on your own. You've let the tornado of the urgent pull you in, and you're missing things like your devotions and like your professional development reading. You've got to get this idea out of your head that you're wasting time when you set aside time in your day to read to further your knowledge. It's a critical piece of what you need to do. And in fact, you should insist not only on yourself and your deputies, but that your faculty are in a constant state of professional development and growth. Now, I don't think I need to emphasize this too much in this group because you're a little bit more open than others, but I do need to say, I hope you're not in the world of, I can only read a book by a Christian because the only people that have anything to tell me are other Christians. Please tell me you're not there. Please. Okay? Because the reality is that the Christian community is not creating really good material on a lot of this stuff. I'm sorry. I'm just going to tell you. I mean, I talk to Christian schools all the time, and they don't even know what I mean when I say a learning community. If I said the DeFores or Marzano, they wouldn't even know who those people are. Well, that's just completely out of the conversation. Whether you agree with these people or not, you need to know who they are and what they're saying. Listen, last time I checked, having been a former classical educator, at the heart of classicism is the willingness to engage in counter-contra thought and wrestle with it. So why wouldn't we do that in our own field? You need to be well-read in all of these things. Because there's a lot going on out there, and we're learning an awful lot about human performance. We're learning an awful lot about students and the way they thrive or they don't. So I love you guys, and I mean that. I am not being cute when I say it. I mean I love you, having been a former classical educator. But this is what I want to say to you, out of love. I don't want to get you angry at me, so just hear me. I worry for you. Some of you have a kind of arrogance in your pedagogy that becomes alarming to me. There's a little too much, I've got the answers, and they're hundreds of years old. So I want to tell you right now, most of you are not running your schools like the ancients did. You're running your schools in very traditional models. There's nothing classical about a 45-minute class period. There's nothing classical about sports teams and all these things. Now, I'm not saying you shouldn't do them. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that it's easy to get in the mode of nah, and to convince yourself that you're in this ancient model that is the bee's knees and doesn't need to be changed or altered or tweaked or upgraded. It's your single greatest danger, I want to tell you. And I want to encourage you, because here's the crazy thing about it. You, more than any group, should be grasping the new educational paradigm. When I look at the innovations that are happening in education, I see classical 2.0 all over the place. But some of you see the great Satan. And it's a conversation that your community has to have. And here's the reality. As long as you only read books from people who agree with you, you're always going to come to the same conclusion. So you need to expand your repertoire and look out there, because I mean it. You guys have some core perennial concepts that are just waiting to launch themselves into the 21st century. You could get a whole generation of homeschoolers to come back into the fold. There's so many things you could do if you would just lighten up a little bit. I love you. I love you. And I want to see you succeed. I have great respect for the Amish, and I'm not being cute. I live out in Philadelphia. I go into Lancaster all the time. Every time one of those Amish carts gets in front of me, I literally am very content and very patient with going behind that Amish cart. In fact, I'll be honest with you. I have a lot of respect because they're willing to put their faith on the line in ways that I never would. But if you're looking for world changers, the Amish are not your world changers. Do you want to be world changers? So, great heads are constantly learning. They're constantly growing. Specifically related to that, I think it's very important as a head of school that you understand that your body of knowledge necessary for you to function well is nothing short of daunting. That's why the head of school is one of the hardest jobs around. I mean, one day you're a history professor or a theologian or a philosopher or a literary person, and somebody taps you on the shoulder and they say, "You'd be a good division head." And you say, "I would be a good division head. Yeah, I think so." And that's your first step into the darkness. Because now, all of a sudden, you have to have these things called corrective action conversations with people. And sit down and look them in the eyes and say, "You're fired," or "You're not performing," or... But then, you do that, okay. You move along, you're grooving with it. And then somebody comes up and they say, "You'd be a great head of school." "I would be a great head of school, I think so." And then your whole world changes. Now you're in the world of human resource compliance, facilities plans, dealing with those people on the board. You're dealing with admissions figures and admissions funnels. You're dealing with advancement and raising money. We all know how you love raising money, right? You're dealing with a host of these competencies that no one ever prepared you for. And so the head of school job, more than any other, is a job that requires you to constantly be learning, constantly be growing, constantly be engaged in new information. And in particular, on the operational plane, this is true of the business side of the house. Now, many of you know my job is the liaison with associations around the nation for ISM. So I work with a lot of association execs. I work with a lot of different associations. I've seen a lot of it. And I've tried over and over again to get a joint conference going for business managers and heads of school. And nobody ever wants to do it. And this is what the execs of major associations around the nation tell me. Now, I don't know if it's right or not. This isn't a research statement. But this is what they tell me. They tell me that they can't pull it off because heads of school are too worried about sitting in a room and having their lack of knowledge of school finance exposed. Now, that's not true of you, but it could be of other people. And so here's the reality. I don't need to become a business manager, but I must know enough about school finance to have a meaningful supervisory relationship with my business manager. I can't just stay in the world of Aquinas and Anselm and Hume as much as I'd love to. I have to break out and I have to get into the world of audits and financial statements and strategic financial plans. I've got to wrap my hands around the money. And I know that you're going to grit your teeth the whole time you're learning about it, and I don't blame you. Listen, I'm a consultant, and I don't even think it's fun. But it's a necessary reality of what you need to gain as a leader. Great leaders are constantly growing and growing in specific ways that keep them moving forward with their people. So there's a lot of talk about wellness, balanced life. I mean, I've been teaching 14 years to leaders and coaching them. And first of all, I just always struggle with this conversation because it's the conversation at which I'm the world's greatest hypocrite. No one lives a more unbalanced life than an ISM consultant, I can assure you. Though I've gotten better at it over time. But here's the reality that we're seeing in schools around the nation. When I walk into any given school in the nation, let me tell you what I'm walking into more and more. I'm walking into a building full of exhausted children and adults. who were so busy working and piling on more and more and more to the schedule that they've gotten literally, and I mean this now in a technical research sense based, they've gotten into a corporate haze. And they don't understand why they're working so hard, but so much doesn't seem to be getting done anymore. And they're sleep deprived, and now it's beginning to affect their judgment, their decision making. It's beginning to affect their relationships. They're getting more curt with people. It's beginning to affect their actual performance. They're working more hours, but they're getting less done. And what happens is you're all like a frog in a kettle. You're all like a frog in the kettle, and you just don't realize it's happening, and you can't grasp why everybody is running around working so hard, but it just seems to never be working. And so as a head of school, you have to set the example, and you have to create an environment where people are not sleep-deprived, where people are not overly stressed, because they won't learn, they won't grow, and your organization will begin to falter if everyone is exhausted. Babies know it. They need sleep. There's bill on 8 hours of sleep, and there's bill not on 8 hours of sleep. And I want to tell you, they're two different bills. And the more I read about this, listen, I was raised by a German father. You know, some of you know this. I've told you, my father, 5 minutes early was late. You know, 5 minutes early was on time. On time was late. You know, my father set the standard. I met it. Great. Don't expect a lot of praise because that's just what you do. You just meet the standard. And so I got this Protestant work ethic in my mind, and the answer to every problem was just work more hours. Just work more hours. Just work more hours. But now as an educator going around and seeing different schools, I'm amazed at the schools in which people aren't exhausted, but things seem to be running even better. I'm amazed when I read about the Danes and the Swedes and the Finns and how they're able to accomplish such high scores but still produce students who are creative, thoughtful, and entrepreneurial and actually get to go home and be children at night. How are they doing that? Well, of course, the experts come in and say, well, they're a homogeneous group and it's a different cultural blah, 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 blah. It's not true. They do it because they realize that humans can be pushed too much and get to a point of diminishing returns. They also do this. They pull from the top 10% of graduates in their country for teachers. So we have to be open to learn from these people. We are in danger right now, not just you guys, but schools across the nation. I'm seeing children that are losing their childhood. And we're doing it in the name of rigor. I'm seeing children, we do surveys, many of you know, tens of thousands of surveys, children, faculty, parents, all of it. So here's what I can tell you. The average high schooler in America today pulls one overnighter. One overnighter to get their work done. The average parent says to us, starting about in their sophomore year, certainly by their junior year, that they are going to bed before their child is because their child is still up doing homework. We have created a narrative in our minds that that's a healthy and good thing. And I propose to you that it is not. So you have to set in your own life an example of health and wellness. In particular, you must not let your day start or end without spending time with God alone and in contemplation with Him and His Word. We all know it, but it's a reality that is so easy. I'm going to be honest with you. I'm going to be transparent as a brother in Christ. It is often the case that that's the first thing I let go when I'm busy, and I make all sorts of justifications. I can hear it now. Lord, I'll get with you this afternoon, but that afternoon never seems to happen. Now, the Lord's with me all the time, but there's a power about being in that space. You know, David talked about it. When I rise up in the morning, the first thing I do, it's almost like by not answering emails and by not doing anything, it's almost like a tithe of your time to say, God, you get the first fruits of my day. Here it is. I'm going to connect to you. You can't let that go by. Martin Luther, as many of you know, was notorious for having devotions that were like 2 hours long. And somebody asked him once, they say, Martin, you know, you're busy, you're running around, you're being chased around all over the place, you know, you're doing all this. What do you do when you know you've got a really busy day and something's really coming down on you? He says, I take 3 hours. Is God our wellspring or is he isn't? If you're too busy to have devotions, then you're too busy. And you need to bring that back in. The second thing is you need to sleep 8 hours. I know it sounds silly. Some of you were like, dude, I came here to hear you tell me to sleep 8 hours. Yes, sleep 8 hours. It's very important. You may not get it every night, but you need to strive to get 8 hours of sleep. Here's what happens when you start to become sleep deprived. You're actually getting less work done, but you don't realize it. Many of the greatest authors in time, there was a study done of great authors that were very prolific writers, and one of the consistent things among writers is that they would set a specific time in the day when they would write. They would write for 3 to 4 hours, and then they would go and ride horses or do whatever it was and whatever it was. There's an amazing power when you step off the crazy train and realize that you actually are getting more done now because you are 100% in the game when you're in the game. Not to mention that you actually are present with your family. You must manage your life in such a way that you can take care of yourself. Now the hypocrisy. You need to exercise. Probably not drink too much beer. Martin Luther would disagree with me, but you need to be healthy. You need to do what you can. Okay. Another characteristic of heads, and then let's see, we go till what time? Okay, so we'll end with this, and then we'll open it up for some questions. Another characteristic of heads is related to time. And now, not so much about your life balance as it is related to your time as far as your work time. Every industry has difference makers. Every industry has that 20% of what you do that nets you the 80% of the benefit. And one of the classic problems that we have, it's been written about for decades in management literature, is that it's so easy to just get pulled off course in your day. It's called by the writer of Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, the tyranny of the urgent. The tyranny of the urgent is your enemy. So let me tell you what your greatest enemy as a leader is. Your greatest enemy as a leader is the merely good. It's the merely good. Here's the truth. Every day you are faced with an infinite amount of good things to do with your time. I'll never forget, I had a great Presbyterian minister who was a mentor of mine. And he said, Bill, there will always be more ministry to be done than there is Bill Simmer to do it. It's always there. And so the reality is that great leaders, first of all, become knowledgeable about what those difference makers in their industry are. Yesterday we were talking about that. At ISM we call them stability markers. Arose by any other name, you need to identify what those difference makers are in your industry, and you need to manage your time in such a way that you can put the preponderance of your time in focusing on those things. Now, anyone who's coached leaders knows that it's an illusion to think that you can control all of your time. I mean, the minute somebody starts talking about controlling all of your time and get to 1 minute manager on me, I just kind of shake my head and go, yeah, right. But you can control some of your time. And you need to be able to lock away a few hours a day in which you are able to get off the grid and focus on those things that are the difference makers in your institution. Some of you are early morning people. Maybe it means you need to get in early before everybody else and do it. Some of you are late night people. Maybe you need to stay a little later and do it. Some of you have an administrative assistant. You got to get an administrative assistant that is Frau Glücker and says, you will not enter here. You got to do whatever it is you've got to do, but you need to systematically set aside time to focus on these difference makers. No one, hear me guys, bring in on this. No one is going to do this for you. You must do it for yourself. You must get out of the lie that saying no is unchristlike. I encourage you to go back to the Gospels. Christ was a fierce human being. He could say no just as easily as he could say yes. And the triune Son of God himself, while on earth, pulled back every so often and got away from the maddening crowd. He talked to people like Martha, and he said, Martha, chill out. And that's from the Greek. So it is not ungodly to say no and structure your time in a way that is productive and healthy and focused. You've got to do it. So first of all, know what they are. Set aside time to work on them and include them as a core part of your professional development. Last piece, and then we'll open it up for questions. You need to be part of a community of other heads of school outside of your school. This is in the new research that's coming out more and more for us at ISM. We're seeing the effective heads around the nation are heads that are part of a cohort or they're on a listserv. Some of them even have a management coach, but they are engaged with other people and they're part of a community. Listen, when you're the head of school, who do you got to complain to, right? Nobody. It's a lonely job, one of the loneliest. And so the only person that you can go to are your fellow heads. You need to be able to have a community of heads. Be careful, because they may give you bad advice, but you just need them to be in the mosh pit with you. If I were making a suggestion to ACCS, I would say, y'all need to create a head, whatever, you know what I'm saying, so that you guys have a support group of heads. All right, so that's down and dirty and quick and listy, but let's open it up for questions. Yes, troublemaker in the back there. That's a great question, and it's challenging with financial literacy, depending upon how deep you want to go in the rabbit hole. One of the things about being a business manager is that more than any other position in your school, they have to constantly stay current with regs and policies and all sorts of things like that. Okay, so there's a lot to keep in the mosh pit with. So you may not be able to reach to that level, but I'm not here to be a commercial. Obviously, ISM has materials that you can order that can help you, and you can understand financial cycles and things of that nature, and what a financial statement looks like, what an audit looks like. So, I mean, you know, guys, I hope you know me well enough to know I'm not in a career where I have to generate a lot of new business, okay? I'm just telling you, God has put me in a place where I don't have to sell anymore. I think he's done it specifically because it gives me a level of integrity. But I'm just telling you, ISM has good stuff. You need to read it. So I would go there. The sad thing is there's not a lot of it in the Christian world, again, because money is mammon and carnal, right? So that would be one of the places I would go. And then I would say, if you have a business manager, I don't know that as a head of school you need to go there, but as a business manager, I would have them join the ISM listserv. That's free. Just join the listserv. And then you've got a community that you can pull from. And then another organization that exists out there, no, I don't get money when you sign on with them, is NBOA, National Business Officers Association. Definitely your business manager should be an NBOA member. I want to say something about that, just real quickly. It's about that money thing. I was so angry at God when he took me out of ministry and put me in ISM. Now, some people laugh at me like, well, you were an ISM consultant. You know, but I really, for me, that was like a second place. And God had sidelined me. What had he done? But now looking 14 years later, I totally see God's hand in it. And this is what I see. I had to get out of the bubble. I had to get out of the bubble and see what the rest of the world was doing. Because as Christian schools, not you guys, but other people, we can get into this bad habit about all sitting in a closed circle, slapping each other on the back, talking about how great we're doing, while Rome is burning. So my point in saying that is this. Groups like NBOA and ISM, for many of you, when you go and you look at the membership fee, you're going to go, yowza, what do you mean $1,500, $2,000 to be a member? We can't afford that. We can't afford that. Here's what I want to say to you. Honestly, with complete sincerity, this is what I want to say. You can't afford not to. How many bad decisions do you have to avoid to pay that $2,000? How many good decisions that you wouldn't have made if you didn't have that knowledge, but now you can, would you make if you would have spent that $2,000? My mother used to say, Billy, good Southern belle, said, Billy, don't you be penny wise and pound foolish. I say the same to you, nix the Southern accent. Don't be penny wise and pound foolish. You are professionals entrusted with the future of the church in the sense of the next generation. You need to spend the money to be excellent at your craft. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. There's a lot to it. And so I'm going to give you the lightning sketch. I mean, I could teach a week. 5 days, 6 hours of instruction on this. But here are the key elements. You have to healthy faculty culture is and how you would do it. So here are the key. First of all, you have to have a mission that's concrete. Most of your missions are all over the map. If I put all of your missions on up right now, they'd all sound like the same. Let me guess. There's worldview, biblical, disciple of Christ, stuff. And here's the reality. I don't mean to be disrespectful, but I can drive a truck through that. That does nothing to help me with programmatic decisions or anything. So I've got to develop three documents. I've got to develop a mission, which should be very focused, short, and not attempt to be comprehensive. It should be focused on my niche. It should say, if I left this marketplace and my school left, what would children not have access to in the absence of me being here? And as classical educators with your idiosyncratic pedagogy, you have lots of material there, okay? So, guys, let's just assume we're teaching a worldview, let's assume we're followers of Christ, and let's just not feel like that has to be in the mission statement. Let's just dive in a level deeper and get more discreet about who you are and your identity. The second document is what we call a portrait of the graduate. All great schools begin with the end in mind. And so what I want is 3, 4, 5, at the most 6, portrait of the graduate items that say, at our school, if your child goes through our program and they graduate, you can expect these as an outcome. And they should be very, again, specific. So your child will have a Christian worldview. Listen, you are all mostly Reformed in this room, and even with that, if I stopped you right now and made you all write a 2-minute essay on what are the core issues of a Christian worldview, once you got past the centrality of Christ and God's Word and your love for Calvin, you would all be writing different things. It's not that a Christian world... Listen, I created Christian worldview curriculum. I taught logic and rhetoric. Nobody's kooky, crazy, wild about a Christian worldview like I am, but that's why I know how big Christian worldview is. It's so big, I'm going to miss the target if I just leave it out in that airy fairy land. So I need to get specific. So I would have one of my items, for instance, would be our graduates will develop a devotional life with God that will last a lifetime. A time of scripture and prayer that will last a lifetime. Yowza, that freaks us out because that's very specific. That's very bam. That's very okay? Our graduates will give of their time, resources, and talent to those in need both locally and globally. See, I'm not just saying worldview. I'm saying here's a piece of that Christian worldview that our school is going to rock the house on. You see what I'm saying? Because here's the truth about organizations. Covey's son, Sean Covey, just came out with a great book that you need to read called Disciplines. I'm zoning. I'm getting old. Sorry. But just look up Sean Covey. But here's the thing. Thousands of organizations sampled, and over again, organizations are stumbling because they're trying to do too much. Better you pick 3, 4, 5, or 6 things and dig in deep and be really good at those things than just bleh. The third piece you need is characteristics of professional excellence, and that takes us to your faculty. Because once I know the outcomes that I'm trying to produce in the life of a child, and once I know what my core niche in the marketplace is, I now know the kind of teachers that I need to hire, not for the school down the street, not for the school in the next state, but for my school. Now, some of those will overlap with other schools, but many of those may be idiosyncratic to who I am, and I need to own who I am in discrete, detailed, focused ways. So that's the first thing, okay? The second thing is I've got to hire based on that, and I've got to do behavioral interviewing. It's not enough to say, do you love whatever? I need to know examples of times when you did it, what you ran into. I've got to interview better. Teacher interviews and hiring needs to be your top priority. Now, I know this isn't the case in your school, but at other schools, it's often the thing that everybody's scrambling to do in between time, in the middle of their day, whatever, whatever. No, stop the madness. The most important thing you can do is hire the right person. If you hire the right person, your life will be so much better. If you hire the wrong person, you will agree with the Catholic view of purgatory very soon. So you've got to hire well. Then you've got to evaluate. Guys, the dog and pony show doesn't work. Can I just... The dog and pony show doesn't work! Maybe it works for new faculty in the first 2 years in an induction process. Sure, I absolutely see saying, I'm coming to your classroom, we're going to have this 6-page rubric, whatever, we're going to film you. Okay, that's all great, and that's great. But once a person gets into their career, your time is infinitely better spent in saying, okay, about every 2 weeks, I'm going to come into your classroom for about 15 minutes unannounced. And when I'm done, I'm going to, within 24 hours, do a short little write-up, and I'm going to give you some feedback. And it may be positive, it may be negative, it may be both, but it's going to be accurate reinforcement, compassionately delivered, with a pro-constituent bias. I want to see you grow. And you get your faculty used to the idea that this is the way we do things around here. And in fact, if you get kooky, crazy, wild, and you have the resources, you might even have peers do it sometimes, just to give peer advice, that never even comes back to you. Just peer advice, for free, with no heat of evaluation. But the problem is that most schools today have the double barrel evaluation feedback framework. Once a year, I load up both barrels and I let them rip at you. Here's the 6-page, 12 rubric point thing that you need to, but I mean, just, I can see the glazed look. People don't grow from that. People don't grow from that. People grow from discrete, smaller chunks of reinforcement given on a regular basis over the course of the year. This is why it's so important that for your division heads, they not become just well-paid secretarial staff, but that they actually are spending about 40% of their time in classrooms, coaching faculty, working with faculty. So if you do that along with a robust induction program for your new students or new teachers, which doesn't have to be all expensive and everything, it just needs to be intentional and well thought out. If you have those things in place, and then ongoing evaluation in a very thorough, objective way, then you begin to rock the house with your faculty. Here's the other thing you do that's great. The other thing you do is you put all the mediocrity on notice. I want a faculty culture that makes mission-appropriate, on-fire faculty members wake up every morning and hear the bell ring. And I equally want a faculty culture that puts a fire up under mediocrity and teachers that won't change their curriculum, that won't do their job, that won't love children, and I want them to become really uncomfortable in my school. Because I don't want to have to go through the hassle of firing them. I want them to self-select their little heinies on out of here and go terrorize some other school. Guys, this is really important, and I want to say this, and I know we're running out of time. There's a lot of research that's just been done recently on Christian schools. And I want to tell you, the people that did it, I was so angry at them. They were all celebrating how great they were because, you know, we're producing lawyers and senators and stuff like that, and our academics are great, and we're whatever. Wow, we have just become so much like the world, okay? Let me tell you the story that they ignored on all of those slides and tapes. There are three bands of outcomes in the Christian school movement that exist. Two of them on either edge are pretty wide, and the one in the middle is actually pretty narrow. The one in the middle is, I am creating a student that actually leaves my school with an intimate personal faith with Christ that's theirs, not superimposed on them because the people in power made sure that they... but that they own. When they leave that school, they continue to follow with Christ. They get into the world, and they are world changers. They are culture changers. That's the thinnest band. The other band that's the largest band is a group of students that basically say, self-report, yeah, well, look, we played the game while we were with you because you had all the power, and we knew that if we misbehaved that you'd smack us down or whatever, but make no illusion, while we were smiling to you and acting like we were being all good kids, let me tell you what was really happening. We made up our mind that we thought this Christian thing was whack-a-doodle. We want nothing to do with Jesus Christ because our experience at your school was such, why in the world would we want to come close to that? And they are alienated from God by us. You Pharisees, you travel the world around and you make a disciple, and you turn him into what? Twice the child of hell that he was before. Then there's the third group over here. I call them the holy sanctified. They self-report that within 3 to 5 years, they have no Christian friends whatsoever in their life. They're in their little holy huddle over here, all righteous, and all talking about how that culture out there is so dirty and ugly, and we really should do something about it. We need to, in a Christ-like fashion, get real about what's happening in the Christian school movement. Now, I know these things aren't happening at your school, but at other schools around the nation. I became a Christian educator not to get them into Harvard. I became a Christian educator to see children's lives transformed and for a generation of children to go out and impact the world for Christ. That's what I got on. God bless you and keep you. Peace. Oh, thank you.